present their arguments today. We're proceeding via Zoom. This is the third matter on our oral argument calendar. I will ask the marshal to call the case, please.
Now calling A210894 in the matter of the welfare of the children of AOK and CLK parents.
And counsel, I have just a few quick remarks before we start the arguments. First of all, we very much appreciate hearing from both lawyers today. And you probably realize that these matters, this hearing is recorded. We will later post the audio recording on the court's website. No other recording is allowed. We are fortunate to be proceeding via Zoom in light of the pandemic. All other things with respect to our rules remain the same. And so I know you're familiar with them. You'll ask questions if you have any. And you also know what to do in case you lose a connection, because I know that's been something that the staff have covered with you prior to the argument. So with that, I'll just remind both lawyers, if you will identify yourself as well as the client that you represent before you start your remarks, we do that to make it clear in the recording. And then if you will also keep your eye on the clock, which should be visible on the screen. So with that, we look forward to hearing from you. Counsel for appellant, you can begin when you're ready.
Good morning, Your Honors. Counsel for respondent, and may it please the court. My name is Michelle Olson. I'm counsel for appellant Father CLK in this matter, and I am asking the court to reverse the trial court's termination of my client's parental rights regarding his two minor children. I think it is important to quote the Minnesota Supreme Court right away, saying, "Yet few children would be reared by natural parents if model parents were the standard. The best interest of the children is a paramount consideration, and our ultimate focus remains on the best interest of the child balanced against the parental rights." That's in matter of welfare of MDO 462 Northwest 2nd. It's a Minnesota Supreme Court case from 1990. It really reflects what this case is about, which is that while my client may have some statutory grounds that would say termination could happen, this is a two-pronged focused test, and the trial court failed to properly analyze under the second prong, which is that in the best interest, whether or not it was in the best interest of the children to allow my client to be terminated from his parental relationship with his children. I think the timing of the alleged incidents are also very important here. None of the incidents are recent. The earliest incident of alleged sexual abuse occurred in 2014 or 2015. There was some discrepancy of exactly when it happened, but it was more than 2 years prior to the birth of my client's first child, and it's more than 5 years after these proceedings had started, which is when it was investigated. The other incidents that have been used to claim my client is an unfit parent were 20 years ago, 20 plus years ago at this point. It is inconceivable to claim that the respondent agency has proved by clear and convincing evidence that my client should have his rights terminated solely based on a potential sexual threat that he could have potentially done to his children, maybe in the future. This isn't a case where there has been any allegations that sexual contact has occurred between the father and his children, that there is an allegation of any actual harm or that the needs have not been met by father. In fact, the Minnesota Supreme Court has allowed parents who have murdered their children and have been incarcerated still allowed a parental relationship with their children so long as it would be in the best interest and they've maintained a parental role. In this case, that is what my client has done. But for the agency removing him from his children's care or from his children to care for them and not attempting to reunify them in some way, that has negated this relationship. That is the sole reason. There is no evidence, and it's undisputed that father has taken good care of his children, that he was taking care of his children. Yes.
Ms. Olson, I think your recitation of the facts is a fair one in terms of what happened in the past, but I think an important aspect here in your focus on the best interest analysis is that there is evidence of concern expressed by several people, including the social worker, including the guardian ad litem, and including the investigator, who have all expressed concern for the children based on not only the past incidents that have occurred, and he even admitted to at least 15 uncharged sexual assault victims that were very young, in right around the age of 5 or so. But child one is right around 5 at the time, and they observed very disturbing and unsettling actions by father with respect to that child. So why isn't that something that the district court could have taken into account? And I think the district court did, in fact, take that into account in determining that there is, that the best interest of the child outweighed the other two factors.
Your Honor, I guess I respectfully disagree that the trial court's finding is appropriate based on the evidence and what was presented at trial. The comments that were made by the social worker were not that the client was inappropriately touching the children. It was called excessive touching, which could not be defined by the social worker herself. It was asked several times, what do you mean by excessive touching? What does that mean? The fact that he picked up his child and held her was considered excessive touching. The fact that the child was hugged was considered excessive touching.
Well, there was also a situation where there was extended period of time where he was rubbing the back and the bottom of child two. And also there was an incident where he grabbed the bottom of child one. And so those were also noted of concern as inappropriate touching situations between father and his own children.
I would respectfully disagree. The incident where he was rubbing the back and bottom of his second child was due to gas and other things that infants could potentially have. And this incident with the bottom, no mandated reporter found it to be inappropriate. It was noted as a concern because there was this allegation made. However, there was actual no incidents where a mandated reporter felt that the touching was inappropriate to either end the visit or to report it as its own contact. The guardian ad litem, again, mentioned this incident where there was some rubbing on the back and bottom. However, they said it was concerning, not that it was sexual in nature, not that anything was inappropriate in nature besides their feeling that it could potentially lead to a sexual threat. Again, the concern that we have here is that we are saying potential issues maybe could happen and therefore you are not allowed to rear your children. That seems to go against the Minnesota Supreme Court saying the parent, the natural parent, is presumed to be the proper parent and
that
should
is
be
true,
the proper
counsel,
parent.
But that is true, counsel, but, and forgive me for interrupting, but do we have to wait until a sexual assault actually occurs before we terminate a parent's rights?
I think if you're going off of a perceived sexual threat based on third parties of incidents that are more than 2 years, the alleged incidents at least are more than 2 years prior to a birth of children, I think you do need more than this could potentially happen.
What authority would you cite for that proposition?
My authority, Your Honor, is based on the fact that we presume parents to be considered the proper parent and the proper person for care.
Right. I understand that broad proposition, Ms. Olson, but is there any case law that says that you can't rely on, for example, maybe stale either convictions or allegations?
I think in the terms of these issues, it could become a statutory ground if it meets the standards. We aren't disputing the fact that there was a conviction and that does create a statutory ground, but this is why we have that two-prong analysis. The second part of the analysis is really to look at right now, what is going on with these children and are they still able to provide care and have care provided to them?
Isn't this really an issue then with respect to a credibility determination by the district court as to the testimony from all of the witnesses and the people who have testified and the district court giving crediting the testimony of the social worker, the investigator, the guardian ad litem and others?
I think it goes beyond that, Your Honor, in the fact that there is a clear and convincing standard. And even if you give credibility to concerns related by the social workers, concerns alone should not be considered clear and convincing evidence that the child is being harmed and the relationship should be terminated. Even if you go with the credibility determinations of the judge in this matter, the trial court, it still has not shown that the children are harmed, that the children are going to.
I understand that, but actual harm is different than we're talking about the potential for harm, but we also have the testimony of other victims as well. It's not just a testimony of the various social workers and others, but it's actual testimony from victims.
We had testimony of two alleged victims at the time. We were not, my client had not been convicted of any of these charges at that time. So we had two alleged victims testify. We had one who he was convicted of, which he pled guilty and successfully completed sex offender treatment for. I think this goes to the crux of the issue of, because he is a sex offender or he was a sex offender, that he is considered to not be able to care for his children. But again, we've had people who have been incarcerated for harming other children, their own children, and they have not had their relationship severed with their other children. They are allowed to maintain the relationship. That is why we look at these four factors of competing interests, the relationship between the child wanting a relationship with parent, the parent wanting a relationship with the child, and the potential competing interests. But even if you look at competing interests, the children had a stable home. They were healthy.
Counsel, as long as you're discussing the district court's analysis on the best interests prong, the district court does spend some time talking about the fact that father had essentially opted not to visit with his children during the final months leading up to trial because he refused to sign the sex offender policy of the supervised visitation center. And the district court found that that would have been relatively a minor change in the visitation procedure, but father nonetheless refused to sign it and that was significant. Would you address that?
Yes, Your Honor. I think there is a significant contradiction in the court's analysis with that. Father had not had this policy. Apparently the policy was being established in January, I believe, of 2020. Father had been grandfathered in. He had already been having care. The supervisors through Keep Me Safe at the Committee Against Domestic Abuse actually questioned whether or not he should have to sign said policy because the policy was not something that he had.
So, you know, regardless of the debate about the policy, the district court did order father to sign the policy, right, in this case. And father refused.
Father refused based on his concern that he could have to potentially incriminated himself. He was concerned about the Fifth Amendment problems, which were things that were argued by the court. The court found that he was required to prove that this wouldn't be an issue, and the court found it wasn't an issue because father didn't do that. However, ordering someone to sign a policy that says he needs to name all potential victims or name alleged victims is an issue that could create a Fifth Amendment self-incrimination. The reason why we haven't presented this argument to the court today is because the bigger issue is whether or not he has met the best interest standard that is required. And the trial, we believe the trial court has not, because again, even with the credibility that the court has determined, the evidence does not supply that the children are harmed or are going to be harmed by their father. There has not
been. It seems to me that what the district court's concern was, and it based on a couple of things, that the father was not truly reformed, despite the fact that he had completed his sentence for the earlier conviction, probation, and had participated in sex offender treatment. And that is relies in part on his refusal to sign his sex offender policy, as well as the incident with his niece, which occurred well after he had completed sex offender treatment.
And I think this gets into the issues with the credibility statements of the children and using these out-of-court statements to assume credibility of them. The statements that were made were through a forensic interview that was conducted in 2019, which is five years after the alleged incidents occurred with a child that was 4 years old. The child apparently said in the interview, and Investigator Reed said that she disclosed something in 2018. However, nobody knows what that statement actually is. I see my time is running out. May I finish the question?
You may. I didn't ask you actually about the admissibility of the out-of-court statement. I realize that's an issue you fully briefed. And of course, we're aware you're briefing on it. And you will have 5 minutes for rebuttal. But if there's one sentence that you'd like to wrap up your answer, feel free to do that.
Yes. So my point here with the admissibility is it's creating a circular logic. So we're saying because it's admissible, he assumed credibility, which assumes there's a perceived threat because of lack of rehabilitation. However, if that evidence hadn't been entered, those facts would have gone away because that he's solely basing it on the interview itself and the credibility of those statements made. And I will discuss more of it during my rebuttal.
Thank you, counsel. So we will reset the clock. And we've done that. So counsel for respondent, you can begin when you're ready.
Thank you, Your Honor. May it please the court, counsel. My name is Jill Jensen, and I represent the respondent, Brown County Human Services. This case is here on appeal on a termination of parental rights. As Ms. Olson stated, the appellant is contesting the district court's findings and conclusions that it is in the children's best interest to terminate parental rights, as well as the out-of-court statements that were admitted of the LK. Since the appellant opened by quoting the Minnesota Supreme Court, I think it's appropriate to also open by quoting the appellant in this matter. And I would direct the court to page 13 of the transcript of the court trial in this case. Question, and how old was the minor victim in that case? Answer from appellant, I believe she was 5 or 6. Question, and what was your relationship to her? Answer from appellant, a father figure. Appellant then goes on to specify how he was a father figure to the 5-year-old child. He subsequently, or at the same time, at multiple different times, penetrated digitally, orally, and attempted to penetrate with his penis. I think that quote, above all else, illustrates how the parent-child relationship is impacted by appellant's sexual abuse of children that are similarly situated to his own children, in that he considers himself a father figure to these children. Now, in this case, the district court's findings regarding the children's best interests are supported by substantial evidence. I would note at the very beginning, first and foremost, that the court made required findings under Minnesota Rule of Juvenile Protection Procedure 39.05. And each of those findings is supported by substantial evidence. The appellant in this case has argued that the best interest factor balancing is inaccurate or is erroneous in some way. There has not been any identification in appellant's brief or an argument of how the court's findings regarding the child's best interests are actually erroneous or unsupported by the record. And so when, as this court knows, when the issue is solely the district court's balancing of the best interest factors. There's scant room for questioning that due to the credibility determinations involved. And first, the court did consider the child's relationship, interest in the relationship. The district court found there is a bond between parent and child. I don't believe appellant to be contesting that finding, and it is supported by substantial evidence. The district court considered the appellant's interest in the relationship, explicitly considered his stated interest that he continued to go to the house and do snow removal and those types of things for the family. But the district court also considered that he chose to discontinue visits, even when he testified that discontinuing those visits would make the children feel abandoned. And the district court did not find how those signing that policy could conceivably require him to make a criminal admission. And this issue was never brought to the court before trial. It was never brought to the visitation center. If it had been, it would have been addressed as stated by the supervisor. The sole issue was that the district court ordered father to sign this policy and make those minor adjustments during visitation. And father actually admitted during testimony that part of the reason he refused to sign it was that he would not be able to physically touch the children. And he said that this would leave them a void. And
so, counsel, let me just back up a second.
Absolutely.
In the district court's analysis of that policy, which is apparently admitted as Exhibit 57, the policy would have required father to disclose his registration status, his list of previous offenses, his list of current alleged offenses, and copies of all requested documentation. I think that's the portion that counsel for appellant is referring to. So when she, and it was just one of her responses, but one of father's responses, but one of the reasons why he declined to sign the sex offender policy and viewed it as an admission.
Yes, Your Honor. And I think the court agreed with me that I don't think there's any criminal admissions required in the provision of those four. The only statement.
Well, help me out then. So if the policy required father to list current alleged offenses, and he were to respond and list those alleged offenses and identify whoever, I mean, isn't that potentially evidence against him? Isn't that father's argument?
I assume that's his argument. I don't understand at all how stating that he is criminally charged with sexual abuse.
Not criminally charged. It's alleged offenses.
Yeah.
It doesn't say criminal allegations. At least that's not what I see. I don't know. You probably read the policy and know it better than I do.
No, I would defer to Your Honor as you quoted it verbatim, I think. So I think stating that you're alleged to have committed an offense against this person is not an admission that you did commit an offense. Those were the only alleged offenses that I was aware of, were the ones that were actually criminally charged. But nonetheless, my understanding is that appellant isn't contesting that. And I think a good point also that the district court made is that he did not attempt to assert his Fifth Amendment right in any way. So it did hold that against him.
And Ms. Jensen, just to clarify, though, the district court did, and it seems like the district court actually acknowledged that the way the policy could be read, it could be to include uncharged offenses, which could lead to making a potentially incriminating statement. So the district court did seem to acknowledge that.
The district court did acknowledge state that in its initial order. However, when appellant made a motion for amended findings, the district court did issue an amended order stating that. Apologies, let me find it. On page 2, paragraph 8 of the district court's order issued let me look at the date. April 23rd, 2021, the district court found that the KMS policy did not require admissions regarding the currently charged offenses beyond the existence of the allegations. The court noted that there is a potential that father might make an incriminating statement. However, he has never identified what this statement would be. Stating the existence of pending charges would not be an admission. He did not assert his Fifth Amendment rights. And frankly, he engaged in conversations with that supervision or visitation center and was offered the chance, and none of this was ever brought up to the visitation center, which had stated that they could have changed the policy. But I think the other point is, if he was concerned that there was a potential for incriminating statements, he never asserted that Fifth Amendment right. So the district court's order could never be held to require him to make an incriminating admission. Regardless of that finding, the district court's continued findings are supported by substantial evidence. As I already stated, the district court did acknowledge that father had a substantial relationship. And in his testimony, again, father did not state it was solely because he apparently believed he would be making an incriminating statement, but that he would not be able to physically touch them, which was one of the reasons that Human Services requested that this be implemented, which, contrary to appellant's argument, was specified multiple times. On page 281 of the transcript, Ms. Nelson was asked why the touch was excessive or inappropriate. And she stated that rubbing of the stomach, rubbing of the head, rubbing of the back, picking up the child and setting the child on father's lap was what was excessive and frequent and what concerned her, especially given the manner in which father behaved toward his other female victims of child sexual abuse. And very specifically, the court considered that that father was rubbing the child's buttocks for minutes at a time, claiming tummy issues. As the court noted, both the guardian ad litem and I believe the social worker stated rubbing a child's buttocks does not relieve tummy issues. And of note, father stated that he had also done this with child one. And I would be frankly hard pressed or surprised to see a father actually commit sexual assault of his children when he's in a supervised visit. And the court did not assign significant weight to the fact that he didn't sexually assault his children in front of the visitation monitors.
Ms. Jensen, and I want to follow up on that point because there is no allegation of actual sexual assault of the children at this stage. All we're talking about is the potential. And isn't that a little disconcerting to think that we would terminate parental rights, which is a fairly significant action, only based on the potential for somebody to, that the court thinks and the people involved think that something might happen, and yet there's not enough there where they would even file for any type of reporting at all as mandatory reporters?
Thank you, Your Honor. Well, the courts have been clear that you can do that. In fact, matter of case welfare of KLW 924 Northwest 2D 649 from the Minnesota Court of Appeals in 2019, in which review was denied, states that you can consider past conduct, but that also it is a reasonable inference that that a person who inflicts egregious harm on a child may later inflict egregious harm on his or her own child. And in this case, very specifically, there is a sustained pattern of appellant sexual abuse as an adult of five-year-old female children. And I'm not talking just fondling, I'm talking multiple incidents of forcible, bribed, attempting to make the sexual abuse appear to be cleaning the child or helpful to the child, at the same time as purporting to be a father figure to that child, as purporting to be a babysitter, as being a close cousin. It's not simply a situation in which 20 years ago, a parent sexually abused someone. It's a ongoing pattern of abuse of trusting and father figure type relationships to sexually abused children that are similarly situated. And in this case, we also have a mother who does not believe the allegations, or I apologize, I'm not going to say allegations. He's been convicted of all of them. None of them are alleged victims. And the court found in this case that none of them were alleged victims, that there was clear and convincing evidence that sexual abuse occurred. So the fact that there is not any evidence that he has yet done this did not dissuade the guardian ad litem, the social worker, otherwise. So for those reasons, the court considered multiple different aspects. It was not just you're a past sex offender. It was you completed these at least up to 15 sexual assaults or sexual assaults of 15 different victims, unknowing about the frequency of those. Not only that, but you completed sex offender treatment. And then the one time that your niece stayed at your house, you also sexually assaulted that child. You also formed some, the appellant in this case also had a very odd relationship with another 10-year-old child. The court read read and considered and received all the visitation notes demonstrating this rapid increase or escalation in physical touch that was noted by many people, not as sexual assault, but is very concerning and atypical of parent-child relationships. And as the social worker noted in an email, was similar to his behavior toward one of his victims. So for all those reasons, the district court's finding on each of these interest factors is supported by substantial evidence. And after balancing those factors, the district court came to the conclusion that it's in the children's best interest to terminate parental rights. I would also note, I think it is important to note that in addition to the touch read about, both the social worker and the guardian ad litem did go to visits, and the guardian ad litem personally witnessed him forcibly hold the child in his lap when she tried to get up, which was also a concern noted by the district court. Since the district court's findings are supported by substantial evidence, there's scant room for review of those balancing factors. With that, I see my time is up, and I would ask that your honors affirm the district court's decision.
Thank you, counsel. So we will reset the clock. 5 minutes. You have it, counsel. For appellant, you can begin your rebuttal when you're ready.
Thank you, your honors. I guess regarding these claims of excessive touch and what the guardian ad litem and what the social worker saw, the social worker and the guardian ad litem had, I believe, two visits total each, witnessing father with his children at the Keep Me Safe residence. And of these two visits, they found that touch was excessive, just based on their visits alone. They didn't see anything inappropriate with the touch. Let me be clear. They didn't file their own report. They didn't make any additional concerns relating to that. They said they found touching to be excessive and it was a concern. However, the dozens of visits with not the social worker and the guardian ad litem found no such claims, no such concerns. If you look in the chronology summaries that were received into evidence, they have continually, the social worker and the guardian ad litem have spoken to the Keep Me Safe workers to ask if he had erections, to monitor him closely. They asked specifically to have the social workers asked for two people to be there because the policy now required him not to be alone with his child in the bathroom, which he was compliant with completely. There were no issues found in the home. Investigator Reed also admits he had never seen any parenting style or any concerns or had any reports that the children may be in danger. His sole concerns were based on alleged historical allegations, and the fact that there are convictions shouldn't even be relevant because at the time of the trial, they were not convictions. They were still going through that process. And again, this leads towards the issue of what we were discussing earlier, which is this credibility argument. We have a very circular logic here that because the statements can be maybe reliable, which we disagree with immensely, but because of that, there seems to be this self-established credibility because they are children and children don't lie. That was the seemed to be the entire basis of the case for respondent agency. However, there is an issue with the reliability of this statement. The statement was made in 2019, apparently after a statement in 2018 in which the parents of the victim, the alleged victim during the trial, didn't believe the child. We don't even know what that statement said. Then we have an interview, which would be a second statement, and there seems to be, well, it's reliable between the statement that the parents told Investigator Reed the child said, and now a forensic statement. Again, we can't confirm that. There's nothing to confirm because no one heard the first statement made. The investigator had a forensic interview made, and that's solely what we're basing whether or not there's reliability and credibility of allegations that were made from 5 years prior. It is important to note that CPS, the respondent agency, actually went to the home in 2016 when the first child was born, found no issues. There was no concerns. They completely closed the matter. It is solely because of these allegations that came in again in 2019 and then historical ones that were based on incidents that happened in 99 through 2001 prior to sex offender treatment. We are viewing what the respondent agency is asking you to do is viewing them in congruency and saying there's this wide pattern for the past 20 plus years of him touching children when that is just not the case. There are two separate
counsel, incidents. Let me see if I understand you correctly. You're arguing that the district court erred in admitting this out of court statement, the forensic interview of LK, the niece, because the district court didn't have the opportunity to compare the 2019 statement with the 2018 statement?
It's one of the reasons, Your Honor. It goes towards whether the statements can only be admitted if they're considered reliable. In reviewing the statements,
given the time, is that your strongest reason, though, for why the district court abused its discretion, or did you want to identify a couple of
my strongest reason is basically the knowledge of the declarant, Your Honor. The biggest issue here is the own testimony of the statement itself didn't actually got contradicted by two other children's statements who were present during the time. She seemed confused. She corrected herself, or she says she corrected herself, and I see my time is up. May I finish my
statement? You can finish your answer.
Thank you. The minor child in this incident, they claim, and what the district court found, was she self-corrected. However, it's not self-correction. She changed her statement. It wasn't, oh, I misspoke, or, oh, I forgot something. Let me tell you more. It was a complete change. Her position of the bed doesn't match the other alleged victim in the matter or the third child that was present. And it also doesn't match the mother who was in the home and and the statements that had been made. Again, the issues we have here are we have a significant inconsistency with this statement, and this statement was used to claim he hadn't been rehabilitated and therefore his rights should be terminated. Without those things, a lot of the findings would get removed. And that is why we're asking for the court to do a thorough analysis of the best interest factors and to reverse the trial court's decision. Thank you.
Thank you, counsel. Our thanks to both lawyers for the briefs, as well as for the oral arguments and responses to our questions today. It's been very helpful, and we really appreciate it. This matter is now submitted to the